Thank you. This talk is taken and amplified from my book, Baseball Greatness, which came out about a year and a half ago, and which is on sale in the vending room, in the McFarland table. And what I'm going to do to begin with is talk a little bit about what I did in that book and introduce you to the methodology so that you'll be able to understand the specific applications of the methodology in analyzing these two very striking sets of Giants teams and what they did and did not do. Also, the book covered through, covered through 2017, but it's been updated already for 2018, and I'm going to continue to update it every year. So, the key to the book is the statistic wins above average, not wins above replacement. Which I applied to players, and then I used the players to apply it, in effect, to teams to discover where team success and failure came from. Now, I was inspired to do all this by the remarkable book by Michael Humphreys, Wizardry, in which he developed defensive regression analysis, which was a methodology that allowed him to get very accurate fielding data for the whole history of Major League Baseball since the 1890s, really. And I don't think anybody is going to be able to improve it up until the era where we have really detailed data on where balls were hit, where fielders are, et cetera. And he had a number for every player, and this was all available in the Oxford University Press website, telling you how many runs this guy saved or extra runs he allowed relative to average for this whole period. Now, wins above average data for offensive players and for pitchers had already been developed on baseballreference.com, and I thought that if I put Humphrey's data into that, I would have a really good number for any player in any year telling you how many wins did this guy contribute to his team as opposed to an average player for that year. Now, why wins above average instead of wins above replacement? This is a very important point. First of all, I think it's more accurate. We don't really know what the value of a replacement player is, and it's certainly variable depending on what kind of player you're looking for and what's happening out there in the minor leagues and so on. We can measure the average for a league very accurately. Secondly, there's another important aspect to this, which I develop more in the book, and I didn't try to put it on a slide or anything. But it's very important to the argument I'm going to make, and I have verified it empirically. Bill James pointed out many years ago in an abstract that the talent in the major leagues among regulars doesn't look like a more normal distribution curve with the bump in the middle at average. It looks like the right end of a normal distribution curve. In other words, when you get down to the lowest level of a regular player, you're getting to a level where there really are a lot of people available. And in fact, what I found is, looking at this, there is very rarely, if ever, a shortage of people who are, let's say, between plus one and minus one wins above average. There are a lot of those out there. And what this means is there's really no excuse for having somebody in your lineup all year who's three or four wins below average. And that's going to be a key to the data that we're going to be looking at in a minute. I do want to say one thing about the way I do wins above average, because it's different from what's on Baseball Reference. I don't adjust for positions. That gives a misleading figure for people's value, and I'm going to explain why that is in just a minute when I get to another key point. Now, the other thing that is key, the other concept that is key, is the idea of a superstar season and exactly what that represents in wins above average and what it means. And here, my debt is to Bill James, who, when he developed the Keltner test way back in the 80s to ask, should this guy be in the Hall of Fame, asked what struck me as the most interesting critical question. Namely, if player X were the best player on your team, would there be a good chance that you could win the pennant? And it seemed to me, if the answer was no, that guy probably didn't belong in the Hall of Fame. And so what I was able to do, developing my database, was to answer the question, how many wins above average does a guy have to be to meet this definition? And what I found was that the vast majority of teams that have reached postseason, 84% now, and before the playoffs were expanded it was higher, have at least one player with four wins above average. you have to have somebody that good, and they're not that common, to get into postseason, to have a pennant-winning team. Thus, developing and maintaining this kind of player is the most difficult thing and the key thing to building a dynasty, maintaining success in the long run. In fact, another thing I found out in the book, which is a very striking finding, is that the number of such people in the majors has fallen drastically in the last 15 years or so. For the whole history of baseball, up until that time, it was pretty steady at about 0.7 per team per league, if you see what I mean. Now it's down to about 0.5 per team per league, and that's one reason that mediocrity is spreading among teams more and more. Okay, so now at this point, when I'm giving a talk, I always like to put up recent data to give you some sense of what a superstar player is. Here's the whole list of people with four or more wins above average over the last season. And again, you see there are not very many of them, and you see a rather striking correlation between having one of these guys and being in the postseason, since most of these guys were on teams that reached the postseason. You also notice that the Red Sox had three of them, which is quite unusual, although we'll run into a team that in that respect was even more unusual as we go on. So, with that preliminary introduction to the methodology, we now move on to Exhibit A, this first group of New York Giants from about 1929 to 1937, which included Bill Terry, Mel Ott, and Carl Hubbell. Now, there wasn't a lot of really high-quality talent in the National League at that point, and these guys towered over everybody. Terry had seven superstar seasons. That's a lot. I might mention, by the way, that five superstar seasons in a career is the effective cutoff, particularly for position players, for the Hall of Fame. That is to say, that's not just my opinion. It's a fact that, with very rare exceptions, everybody who has five such seasons is in the Hall of Fame, with just a few exceptions. Whereas if you look at the list of people, which is larger, with four such seasons, most of them are not in the Hall of Fame, although some of them are. So anyway, Terry had seven, Ott had 11, which is an absolutely monster number, which obviously extends beyond the boundaries of this period. And Hubbell had four, which is the most of any pitcher in that era in the National League. Dizzy Dean had three. So, again, in the other league, you had the team that was a dynasty that had three comparable players, although Grove is better than Hubbell, and who did win three pennants in a row by big margins. Now, the Giants didn't do that. Now, why didn't they do that? And to answer that question, we start to look. Now let's compare the Giants, first of all, to the other teams to make this point in a different way. This is how many superstar seasons you see in each of the three leading teams, the Giants, the Cardinals, and the Cubs, during these 9 years. And it's interesting because these teams won all the pennants in these 9 years. In fact, each of them won three times. And you see the Giants, in the course of this period, have 21 total superstar seasons, more than twice as many as the Cards, who have nine, and the Cubs, who have seven. And yet, they were not able to win more pennants than either of the other two teams. And to answer the question of why not, and I'm not going to look that closely at these Giants, although I'll look at a couple of the series because I want to spend more time for the ones we all remember, we look at some of the seasons in question. So first of all, we have 1930, where the Giants lost by five games to a Cardinals team, which wasn't particularly impressive. What we see is here that the Giants' top four offensive players outperformed the Cardinals. They had 17.6 wins above average to just 7.9 for the Cardinals. So if each of the teams had average players at the rest of their lineup and about the same pitching, the Giants would have won easily. But in fact, once you get beyond those top four, the rest of the Giants' team is a full minus 6.9 wins above average, seven full games, worse than the Cardinals. So the total lineup is only three better, as opposed to so much better among the top three. Meanwhile, The Cardinals had a much better pitching staff overall. In fact, even Burleigh Grimes was a little better than Hubble. And they had about an 8-game edge in the pitching staff, and that accounts for the fact that they were able to win, despite the fact that their top players were not nearly as good. I might point out, by the way, when we're looking at the lineup and the number, just to repeat, the number for the individual hitters, lineup players, includes hitting and fielding, and that will become important in a minute. Now, the big culprit, and not for the last time, on the Giants is their second baseman, Huey Kritz, who was a terrible hitter and most of the time a terrible fielder, and who cost them almost a full 5 games below 500 all by himself. Just replace him with somebody who's average, and it would be a whole different story. Now, in 1931, the Cardinals managed to improve a little, and Kritz actually improved all the way to average. But the Giants in 1931 missed their Pythagorean percentage by 6 games. The Cardinals exceeded them by 4, and they won easily. Now we get to the two most interesting years in this period. In 1932, McGraw's last year, Terry took over during that year. And in 1933, when Terry had his first full year as manager and was really a miracle man. Now, this is pretty striking because in 32, Ott, Terry, and Hubble, between them, combined for 20 wins above average, which is a very impressive big three. In other words, if the rest of the team had been average, along with those three guys, they would have won 97 games, which would have been easily enough to win the pennant. But even though those top two guys, between them, are worth almost 14 wins above average, the lineup as a whole is perfectly average, because of all the dreadful people they have playing for them. First of all, you have Kritz, who isn't doing any better. He's minus 4.3. You have Freddie Lindstrom, who's a disaster as a fielder in center field, minus 2. You have two shortstops, Jackson and Marshall, combining for almost minus 4 between them, and several other people who are way below. Now, on top of that, the Giants managed to miss their Pythagorean percentage by 10 games this year, which is a lot, as you all know. And thus, while they projected to be at about 500, they wound up 72 and 82. The Cubs, on the other hand, in 1932, had a very mediocre team, but exceeded their percentage and managed to win the pennant, I think, without a single superstar. Okay, so what happens in 1933? This is really fascinating because the first thing that happens is that the great players have, by their standards, really pretty mediocre years. They don't do that well at all. Their net total falls from 20 to 11. So they are giving up 9. But in the meantime, there are several huge improvements. The first one is the second base where Kritz suddenly improves his fielding drastically, I don't know how, and winds up as an asset. Suddenly he's a big asset. Then replacing Lindstrom with Joe Moore in center field is a big help, since he emerges as a good player, and at shortstop they do much better too. Now they do win only 92 games, it's a very mediocre league again, but that was enough to win the pennant. Now I'm going through quickly for the rest of this period, because I do have a lot to say about the Giants down the road. Actually, in 1934, they were unlucky. They lost to the very overrated Gashouse Gang, even though they were about 4 games better than the Gashouse Gang, at least that, actually, in their Pythagorean projection. And in fact, they continued to improve. Terry Ott and Hubble did better, as you see, and everybody else did too. But the Gashouse Gang, very luckily, won the pennant by 2 games. In 35, they generally had a bad year. The Cubs had a worse year. The Cubs had a very good year with a very strong team and won. Now, they did win, again, in 36 and 37. There was a good deal of luck involved there. The Cubs were better than they were in 36 in raw totals. They were about the same in 37. Now, by this time, Terry only played half the season about in 36. He retired in 37. He wasn't a factor anymore. But Dick Bartel came in and was an outstanding shortstop and actually had 2 superstar years of his own in those years, mostly in the field. So they won two pennants with 92 and 95 wins. But even then, they still had these two disastrous third basemen with Travis Jackson in 1936, costing them four wins, and Lou Chiozza the next year doing about the same. So the bottom line on these guys was that with a better supporting cast in 30, 31, 32, I think they could easily have won at least two more pennants in those years and have had three out of four from 30 to 33. But they didn't have it. Nobody was minding the store. So now, as I say, we move to a much more recent, familiar cast with an equally interesting story. Here we have four Hall of Famers. Cepeda is a little marginal but for the Hall of Fame, by my reckoning. He had only three superstar seasons, actually, but certainly a very fine player. The other three are unquestionably all-time greats. So we're going to start out with 1962, when they really did it right, which is kind of interesting. You have Mays with 7.3 wins above average, and he's consistently at 5, 6, 7 for his whole career up to this point. It's just amazing. He's the only superstar on the team, actually, but everybody else is good. Philippe Alou and Jim Davenport have very fine years. I call those star years. McCovey, a little behind. Cepeda's having an off year, but he's still contributing. And everybody else is perfectly average, except Jose Pagan. Well, you can afford one guy at minus 2.6. And they win 103 games, 101 during the regular season. They have about the same winning percentage as the 54 and 51 teams, which are the other best teams of the Stoneham Giants. So all that looks good, and it looks very good for the future. But here we have the most extraordinary case of all. This team, these 1963 Giants, have four superstar seasons. There are only seven teams in the whole history of baseball that have done that. Seven. Some of them are the 27 Yankees, the 42 Yankees, and the two since then are the 1972 Reds and the 2001 Seattle Mariners, who you remember won 116 games. I can go into more detail about that in the Q&A if you want. So, in addition to that, they have Philippe Alou. And what that means is that these top four players were 22 wins above average. Okay, add that to 81. With an average supporting cast, you would have had 103 wins, and you would have easily won that pennant. They also have Philippe Alou, who again is a star and doing very well. But everybody else, as you can see, is dropping off the charts. In addition, the pitching is still good, but despite those fantastic four top people in the lineup, including Philippe Alou, who have almost 20 wins above average, the whole lineup is only plus two. And they are beaten by the Dodgers and the Cardinals in that year because of this very sad supporting cast. I want to mention a couple of other things, one thing that I found very interesting. And again, Michael Humphries really opens your eyes about a lot of fielders because we've never really known who was good and who wasn't. Willie McCovey, believe it or not, was quite an adequate left fielder at this stage in his career. No, he wasn't a huge asset out there, but he wasn't a huge deficit either. And I'll return to something like that again. But then again, everybody else is falling off badly except the catchers. So then we go into 1964. And now they've made one terrible mistake. They got rid of Philippe Alou, basically for nobody. And he was only going to get better and better with Atlanta. But they've got Jim Ray Hart, another very interesting player. Never cracked the four barrier, but was over three a number of times. And again, like Willie McCovey and like a number of other power-hitting third basemen, such as Tony Perez and Dick Allen and Bobby Bonilla, it turns out that he too was a perfectly adequate fielder, although people didn't think that he was. And he made a number of errors, but he had plenty of range. So, in 1964, the pitching staff is tremendous, thanks partly to Merrichal. They're 12 wins above average. But even though we have those three excellent people at the top with about 14 wins above average, the whole lineup winds up severely in negative numbers, almost 4 wins below average. This team finished fourth. They almost eked into the pennant thanks to the Phillies' collapse, but they're behind the Phillies and the Reds and the Cardinals, who won. But again, with a reasonable supporting cast, they easily could have done much better. Now, the next one, I'm introducing a comparison with another team, which is very revealing. Now, here we have Willie in one of his greatest seasons with 8.5, which is an awful lot. Mike Trout has never had 8, by the way. We have McCovey and Jim Ray Hart, not breaking the barrier, but very good. But again, the whole lineup falls all the way down to minus 5.8. We also have Juan Marichal. A lot of that is fielding, by the way. These guys don't look quite that bad at bat, but their fielding doesn't help either. We have Davenport playing shortstop, which was a disaster, and Matty Alou and Hal Lanier, an even bigger disaster, and so on and so forth. The pitching staff is actually absolutely outstanding, but that's not enough to make up for the lineup. Now, what about the Dodgers? And this is what is so interesting. Okay, the Dodgers have one superstar on the scene, Sandy Koufax, and he's outpitched by Marichal. They have nobody anywhere near that level in the lineup, but they don't have anybody significantly below average in the lineup either. And they have infielders who are contributing positively in contrast to the Giants. And this is enough to give them a superior team. And in fact, this pattern persists into the next decade with the Dodgers when they develop that whole new infield that plays for so long. And those guys are never superstars. I don't think Garvey even was ever a superstar, but they're solid and they contribute, and this makes a huge difference. So the Giants this time lose out by 2 games. Now, there's one other point to make here. Time's getting short, and I won't be able to do some of the extra things I wanted, but that's all right. There was a lot of talk, as you remember, in the 60s, about the trouble with the Giants is they're not one team, they're 3 teams. There's a white team, there's a Negro team, using the contemporary term, there's a Latin team. Well, they didn't go far enough with that, because what's the real problem? Well, the real problem is the black team, Negro team, is tremendous. It's full of superstars. The Latin team runs the gamut from superstars to much less. With the exception of the catchers, the white team is terrible, year after year after year. And that is why they don't win. So we go to one more iteration in 1966. And again, Willie has slipped just a tiny bit, but he's still way, way ahead of anybody else in the league. McCovey is really hitting his stride, doing better. Hart is having a tremendous season. And yet, even starting out with, 13-5, about 17 wins of average, above average from those three, the lineup winds up plus 2. We have some terrible people in the outfield now, too. Len Gabrielson, Cap Peterson, people like that. And again, in the Dodgers, you see something very different. Their lineup is a little better. They have stronger performances from LeFevre and Parker and Willie Davis. Now, again, the difference in those lineups, a lot of it is fielding. And those Dodgers were very good fielders, and that makes up for a multitude of sins. And in fact, you see, this is an interesting thing about those Dodger teams. Sandy Koufax was never overrated at all, despite Dodger Stadium, but the rest of the Dodger pitching staff in those years really was. And what made it look good was the combination of Dodger Stadium and the outstanding defense, led by Willie Davis and a couple of others. But actually, Austin and Drysdale in those years was only a little above average. Drysdale, ironically, had his best years in years the Dodgers did not win. So let's go to the bottom line, not only with respect to this, but with respect to the whole topic. First of all, the Giants easily could have won at least 2 more pennants during these years. Secondly, I never hesitate to quote somebody else, in this case, my great friend Dick Kramer, who said what I wanted to say better than I could. It's much easier to get rid of a way above average player with an average one than to find a new superstar. And I'll just show you one other thing. Okay, this proved out in this 28-13 period. This I discuss in more detail in the book also. The Yankees and the Red Sox have many more superstars than the Rays. The only superstars in the Rays were Evan Longoria and David Price, basically, and once Carl Crawford. But the Rays consistently fill up the lineup with young people who are good athletes, who don't give away runs in the field, and who are about average. Whereas the Red Sox and Yankees are filling their lineup with a lot of aging veterans, and every year a couple of them are just awful. And as a result, the Rays competed on basically equal terms with those two teams all through that period. Okay, thank you very much. And I hope we can have a couple questions. Yes. Well, he did, yes. He was already above average. If you remember, I think he won 20 games very early in 1966, and then he didn't win in his next 10 starts or something like that. But that's true. He didn't. He was not the player he was going to be at that point. Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to have to clear the room for the next presentation. David will be here if you want to ask him questions.
Okay. Could we have one more?
Okay, one more. Yeah. Quick one.
No, he had been with them in 62 as well. He had been with them all that time. Well, no, he had been with them in 62 when he was still with them then and for years after. That's another thing. I mean, it was just incredible to be platooning Keene with McCovey. I mean, Keene was a worse fielder in left field than McCovey at that time, but they did it. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, David.
Yep.